The Guardian.
Egalite at Anfield, Fraternite pre-game at the Emirates, and Liberté, where Swansea play their matches and secured a vital win this weekend in the relegation race. With Arsenal ending their Jose hoodoo, their Jose jinx, it was a good weekend for French leaders, and we'll be rounding up all the Premier League surprises. Sunderland beating Hull, West Brom scoring goals. We'll also take stock of the Championship, League One and League Two playoffs, and look forward to the midweek European semi-finals. Will Atletico be less patético in their almost goodbye to the Calderon? And in a big week for French folk defeating dangerous old ladies, can Monaco spring an upset on Juventus? It's semi-interesting and on the way in this Football Weekly. Hey everybody, and welcome to another edition of my favourite football pod. Especially today, because we've got niceness on two legs, Ian McIntosh here.
Hello.
Hello, Ian. Curmudgeonly Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
But beneath his crust exterior beats a heart of gold.
Does it?
Yeah, it does, actually. Okay. Yeah. And Simon Burnton.
Hi.
Watford's very own.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. Woof. If we sound a bit high on life, everybody, it's because Sunday. How about Liverpool, Southampton, and especially Arsenal, Man United? Arsenal. Wenger finally beating Mourinho in the league for the first time ever, and Arsenal relaunching their top four hopes, but all a lot less interesting than that sounds. Ian.
Yes. Yes. It started well, Arsenal, Man United. Yeah, there were lots of things happening, and then all of a sudden it was just wraiths wandering soullessly across the pitch. It was very sad.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about what these games were, sort of 10, 15 years ago, they were season-defining clashes, and this was god-awful.
On the telly on Sunday night, they pulled up the fact that even before it started, the warning signs were there that this wasn't going to have the same intensity, when basically tunnel scenes that resembled some kind of Tupperware party.
Yeah, it was... I don't think Manchester United were particularly bothered.
Well, I mean, apparently they weren't. Especially Jose, he said, "I'm not bothered," well, at the end.
That was my clue. Yeah. That led me to that conclusion.
What do you think, Barry?
There were very unseemly scenes in the dressing room, you know, rather than carbohydrate-heavy fast food being flung around in anger. It was all hugs and handshakes and cuddles. You know, what Roy Keane and Patrick Vieira must have thought if they were watching, I shudder to think. And, a lot of the Arsenal and Manchester United old boys have been complaining about that. Ian said it started well. I suspect that possibly might be because it followed Southampton, Liverpool. So the entertainment bar was so, so low that anything would have been an improvement.
Right.
But a good win for Arsenal, a good win for Wenger because he gets that Jose hoodoo or albatross off him from around his neck. And is that what you do albatrosses? No, it's millstones around your neck.
You get off the millstone, yeah. You try not to get an albatross in here.
No, I mean, they'll resist. Right. They're not particularly friendly.
But as you say, a good win for Arsenal, for all of the lack of...
Yeah, and for all that Jose Mourinho is pretending he doesn't care about it, I suspect he cares a little bit.
World-class trolling by Mourinho afterwards. I mean, absolutely buried the needle with the whole, "I'm really happy for Arsenal fans. Yeah, they're a big club and they haven't had much to cheer about. I'm delighted for them." You know, you're not really supposed to say that when you're the manager that's just lost to them.
Well, yeah. But they do have things to cheer about. Three at the back is working out well, isn't it, Simon?
For Arsenal. I mean, the last few weeks have brought a couple of results that might go some way to restoring a semblance of vague hint of half-decent reputation to Wenger when he says goodbye in the summer, and the FA Cup semi-final and then this.
That's a big shout.
Well,
do you base that on anything apart from...
No, absolutely nothing whatsoever. No wild assumptions.
Okay.
So the semi-final was a big win, and this, for all United's lack of ambition, was a very desperately needed home result for Wenger in particular. Had it gone the other way, obviously Arsenal's season would have been, but for the cup final, dead.
Cup final's quite a big thing.
Quite a big thing. Yeah. It is okay, but their league position would have been, I mean, it may still end up being pretty faintly embarrassing, but there is at least some hope that they might rescue something in the league.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this result goes some way to restoring their top four chances. They're
sixth. I just think it's they tend to finish seasons well. I'm just looking back over the last four seasons, say their last 10 league games of each. In total, they played 40, won 24, drawn 13, and lost just 3.
Ooh. The run-in looks quite favourable. They have the game Wednesday night at Southampton. Then I think it's Stoke away, isn't it? And then home against Sunderland and Everton. Ooh, Everton's form on the road, not the best, as we'll touch on later. But as it stands, Arsenal lie sixth. If they do beat Saints on Wednesday, they'll be fifth, 3 points off the top four, and only 4 points behind Liverpool in third, with a game in hand on Jurgen Klopp's men.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's in their hands. It's just that's the last place you want to keep anything safe. It's in Arsenal's hands. and with Liverpool playing so weirdly, it's still up for grabs. I mean, there are a few positives here. Mm-hmm. Oxlade-Chamberlain was very good again. Ramsey was excellent, particularly in the first half. Xhaka was decent.
Yeah, Amy Lawrence was suggesting he may be the answer. I didn't read the article to see what the question was, but I'm assuming it was something.
she was saying that obviously the ideal Arsenal midfield is Santi Cazorla plus one.
Oh yeah.
But identifying that plus one and having a consistent plus one is the tricky bit.
But only now that you've got three centre halves ready to cover whatever deficiency that two man midfield.
Exactly. Okay. I mean, it would actually help if Sanchez hadn't sort of tailed off so drastically.
Did he tail off?
I thought he was
vital and intense in this game. A little bit too intense at times.
I didn't really think that much of him, to be honest. Maybe he was just outstripped by Ramsey. Same with Ozil. I saw people rating him. But again, I mean, you're talking about two sort of supposedly world-class players.
Right.
I'm not sure what they offered was quite there. But also lovely to see Danny Welbeck back as well. One of my favourite players.
And I suppose in many ways on a Sunday that saw a triumph of love and decency and general goodwill, we should salute the scenes of amity in the tunnel. And should be thankful the days of snarling hatred and division are over the tunnel, as elsewhere, in places elsewhere. So can they win at Southampton? Simon?
Well, Southampton are not in their strongest place at the moment, not playing particularly well. I guess you'd probably make them favourites for that game.
I'd be interested to see how dry the pitch will be at St Mary's. Jurgen Klopp saying afterwards, I know nobody wants to hear it, but I am brave enough to say it, the pitch was really dry today.
He's definitely right about the first bit. it was just such a bad game.
And this is Liverpool-Southampton.
Yeah, there was a point midway through the first half where I suddenly sort of almost jerked conscious.
Oh.
I think I've been in a...
Lucky conscious.
I've been in a gorm for about 20 minutes thinking, have I missed it? Has anything happened at all? And I don't think anything at all happened in the first half, bar a couple of long shots. They're just that zip about them mentally and physically from the first half of the season seems to have gone. When they broke, they were all little clever flicks and sprints, and obviously Sadio Mane's absence is hurting them for the second time this season. But it's the speed of thought as well that seems to have gone. They're just taking longer, getting the ball further forward, and with that, everything seems to break down. I think if they can scramble a top four finish out of these performances, then they've done very well indeed.
Right, interesting.
I mean, that's the fourth time this season they've failed to score against Southampton.
Wow.
Which is kind of extraordinary, really. Jurgen Klopp seemed very reluctant to do anything about it. I mean, he didn't bring on a sub till 70 minutes.
Yeah.
Then he brought on Lallana and Sturridge, and they did kind of have a bit of an impact, you know, crank things up a notch.
Well, there was that penalty, of course.
Yeah. It was a very good save. I don't think it was particularly bad. I suppose if it doesn't go in, it's a bad penalty, but I've seen a lot worse. But it was just an outstanding save by Fraser Forster.
Yeah, after he'd got into James Milner's head.
It was strange that Forster went unpunished for that, for what seemed a fairly aggressive act of gamesmanship. While Ward-Prowse, for example, was booked for going and having a drink at the same time, it seemed as if perhaps the referee was cowed a bit, as Milner was, by Forster's giant stature and yep. when to pick on the smaller guy.
Perhaps so. Saints with no shots on target in that entire match. And did you know that Jurgen Klopp now has a worse record as a Liverpool manager after 66 games than Brendan Rodgers? It's quite yeah. a wide sample, isn't it? 66 games, and statistically, he's doing worse.
Yeah, well, I mean, it makes sense. Brendan Rodgers' second season was pretty decent.
There you go. All right. Well, anyway, what we haven't talked about yet, though, is Man United and what this means for their end of season and Thursday night's game with Celta Vigo. Their 25-game unbeaten run has now ended. And they continue this record of not scoring away against any of the top six sides. They haven't done it all this season. They've still got a game against Spurs to try their luck with.
Well, I suppose when you're using, you know, your best attacking talent as playing them as fullbacks,
right.
it's going to be difficult to score, isn't it?
Yeah, Mkhitaryan and who's it, Mata?
Mata.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're like, they didn't get forward at all. It was that's what makes me wonder or sceptical about Jose Mourinho's assertion that he didn't care about the result. If he didn't care, why set out his soul in such a defensive manner?
Mm-hmm. Why not go for it?
Yeah. And, you know, is he just obsessed? Was he obsessed with maintaining this spectacularly underwhelming, unbeaten run?
No, it's a fair point. It does suggest he absolutely did care about not losing this game.
I think he did, yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. So, yeah, Mkhitaryan and Mata sacrificed to basically just follow Oxlade-Chamberlain and Gibbs up and down. It's now well over two years since any Mourinho side has scored in an away game against a top six side. That's remarkable, isn't it?
It is remarkable. It's indicative of his approach to all big matches now. I mean, he is the ultimate bus manoeuvrer, you know, having come up with the phrase himself. He'll be damned with it.
He kind of has to win the Europa League now, or his first season in charge of United will have been a total failure, you'd think, considering the amount of money he's spent. If he finishes fifth, sixth, and doesn't get a place in the Champions League next season through the Europa League, then I'd be very interested to hear how he would spin that as any sort of success.
Two words for you, Barry. League Cup. But yeah, absolutely huge on Thursday, but a slip up there, you have to feel it's going to be a little bit catastrophic. Anyway, that's been quite a fair chunk of chat. So how about we take a quick pause before we address the remarkable events Friday night at the London Stadium? Hey! West Ham Spurs happened on Friday night. Ian McIntosh, perversely, watched it on Monday morning.
I did, yeah. I was out Friday night, and then
right.
I meant to watch it Saturday, but
I was
on a train. I just went out in Kentish Town.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Very nice it was, too. But then I had to get up at 6 to go up to Manchester, so,
right.
you know. Long story
city,
short, I never got to see the game until this morning.
Okay, and what did you make of it?
I know, obviously, we're going to spend a lot of time on Tottenham, but just to start, I thought Slaven Bilic did really well, did a job on them. They went with the back three, but they also went with a kind of block of four midfielders, two defensive midfielders and two central midfielders. So whenever Tottenham broke, trying to do that lovely, quick, fast-paced technical football they like, there was just no room. There was nowhere they could go. West Ham's fullbacks were excellent at blocking up the space. They were aided a little that Kyle Walker, for reasons I can't begin to imagine, was distinctly off form.
Was it a strange decision to put him back in the side? I thought he played it as last game for Spurs.
I mean, just hindsight is always 20-20. Maybe Pochettino thought he could just get on with it and play a decent game, as many players can do, in spite of speculation, but it didn't happen.
Generally, once you've displeased Pochettino, that's it. If you're frozen out, there's no coming back from it.
Also, because Kieran Trippier had done such an outstanding job in the previous matches.
Yeah, he's been excellent. And that's if it is a power play by Walker trying to force something through, it's not going to work when Trippier's in that sort of form. But it was obvious from the start. His touch was off. He let the ball run out of play. There was a wild tackle that got him booked. And he was at fault for Lanzini's goal as well. He just sort of switched off into standby mode and let Lanzini sit unmarked on the edge of the six-yard box. West Ham did very, very well. As for Tottenham, I mean, it's a bit hard to accuse them of being bottlers when they just won 9 on the bounce. They did look a little bit leggy towards the end of the game, particularly in their tracking back. But some days, you know, you get those games where you've got a packed defence and also a team that's very capable of breaking, and the game just sort of slipped away from them.
Indeed. All right, well, Chelsea can secure the title before Tottenham take the field again. That's if they beat Middlesbrough Monday evening and then West Brom on Friday. Huh. Anyway, they've got a decent run in Chelsea and they've won this title. Now, you said you had to get up early on Saturday morning because you were going to the Etihad to see, excuse me, Manchester City playing Palace. Where on earth did this come from, Ian?
There's been little glimmers of it here and there. Away at Southampton, once City had the first goal, they seemed to kind of look a lot less anxious and a lot more fluid. And they've had this performance in them, I think, for about 6 weeks or so, because their attacking lineup. I mean, David Silva, I don't know anyone who doesn't think that David Silva's one of the best players in the Premier League.
He's one of the best players in the Premier League. I think the question would be, why is it that he obviously had a fantastic game. I'm not blind to that.
My timeline was just on Saturday afternoon.
No, I didn't say anything this time, but in the past I've questioned his efficacy. For all his pleasantness on the eye, how much he's actually effective in terms of what he does with the possession and in terms of how much he makes them win big games. And I don't want to be that guy like people used to be about Zlatan saying, yeah, but... So I salute this game, even though it was against the Palace side who were well off their best. But he certainly in this game did look spectacularly good.
Yeah, I mean, he was wonderful, especially for the fact that he wasn't even supposed to play. Apparently, the medical staff just sort of said, yeah, he seems all right. Kicked his tyres, he's absolutely fine. And it was just a wonderful performance. He just controlled the midfield to the extent that when he was subbed off with about 20 minutes to go, even Palace supporters were joining in the standing ovation. It was a fantastic display. I particularly liked as well, you tell Guardiola, once he'd sort of locked down his formation after those horrific defeats, most notably the 4-0 at Everton, sort of stopped messing about with a back three for a couple of months and was a little bit more cautious about everything. But he's back into doing weird little tactical flourishes, like his old favourite of doubling up on the wingers. Hmm. So we'd have Sane as a right winger, but Kevin De Bruyne about 5 yards behind him, so they could double man Patrick Van Aanholt. And then 10 minutes later, you'd see De Bruyne up over the other side, 5 yards behind Raheem Sterling to befuddle Joel Ward.
De Bruyne still finding time to take his number of league assists to 44 since the start of 2014, more than any other player in Europe's top five leagues. Boom, how about those for numbers? No player has been more involved in Premier League goals for Man City this season than De Bruyne. 5 of them and 14 assists now. Huh. Because he's been quiet this year, De Bruyne. And yet, those numbers.
He's an extremely vital player. He creates hope and life, as well as, obviously, goal-scoring situations. Company scored a fantastic goal.
Company did.
What a strike.
Yeah.
For a centre-back.
It's just remarkable. And him being fit, is that a thing now? Is company being available?
It's temporarily a thing.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, but he's fit until he next is not fit.
Oh, right, okay. But that's 4 games now.
Yeah, yeah. And he really is transformative. To the City's defence has been really quite poor for several seasons. Hasn't been fixed by Guardiola, but his presence in it massively improves it.
All right. Yeah. No Aguero in this match. And they still got 5 goals.
Yeah, I think that's quite possibly the Manchester City of the future.
Really?
It's still not entirely clear what the problem is between Guardiola and Aguero. Given that Aguero's been so awesome for so long. He's always sort of preferred younger players, hasn't he? Particularly up front, more sprightly ones. Which is one of the reasons that Sam Allardyce made a quite odd tactical twist. He said that because the Man City attackers were all so small and fast, he left Damien Delaney, the hulking great rock troll that he is, on the bench, and he put Jeffrey Schlupp at centre-back.
That went well.
Yeah, I don't know if it was him particularly. I mean, Martin Kelly had an absolute stinker, a 62nd period where he gave an assist to David Silva and a yellow card as well on the halfway line. But Palace were dreadful. If City were a team in Guardiola's image, Palace were quite the opposite of Allardyce's image. They just, defensively, they were all over the place.
Is that what Allardyce said? I was curious. I just thought he perhaps didn't rate Delaney because he hasn't got many games under Allardyce.
No.
He did bring him on, didn't he?
Eventually.
He got a late booking at one point for a scything challenge.
it doesn't seem that all is well there. Without Sacco, that defence looks particularly rickety and unable to react.
And their end of the season beginning to look a little bit interesting again. 4 points from the drop. And next weekend, they're taking on Hull, the team that they are 4 points above. That's at Selhurst Park. Let's talk about the situation at the bottom. Hull, beaten at home by Sunderland. Barry, is there anything worse that Sunderland could have done for their supporters than get relegated and then immediately go and win a game?
Well, I told you it'd happen.
To be fair, you did, and I poo-pooed you.
You scoffed. And you weren't alone in scoffing, I should tell you. But, I just monotonously predictable. To be fair, I'd say Hull will look at the video of that and just wonder how the hell did we lose that game.
Because how did they lose that game?
Well, it was a combination of some shocking finishing. Ndai had a horror miss. Nias had a miss. He's been in form, missed a couple. And Jordan Pickford, once again, was absolutely outstanding in the Sunderland goal. He made several excellent saves. One from a Lazar Markovic header that looked bound for the top corner. And, he was just unbeatable.
Hmm? And he very nearly assisted, set up a goal for Defoe as well. Pickford's kicking, as much as his shot stopping, which impresses me, I think his distribution is phenomenal.
Right.
It's like his long range distribution with the ball in hand or on the ground, phenomenal. Like, extraordinarily good. And depending on where he goes to next, his next team may not make use of it as much as Sunderland have. And the Sunderland have basically don't have, he's their best creative player, pretty much. Many teams won't want their goalkeeper to be kicking long that often.
Right.
But he's phenomenally good at that.
How's his close control? How's his short range? Is he a Man City-style keeper, do you think?
I can't remember being more excited by a young goalkeeper.
Really?
Yeah. The fact, it's not... So his shot-stopping is excellent. We see that every week. His control of his area is good. And his distribution is phenomenal. And it's really rare to get that full combination in a young keeper. Now, because of his ability at long distance passing, I think that maybe going to a Manchester City isn't... I think they won't use the full breadth of his talents.
Right.
But maybe, Liverpool could say...
Everton? Yeah, Ronald Koeman, sort of tactical pragmatist, does what works on the day. He'd love someone with kicking like that.
Jordan Pickford. How old is he, Simon?
23.
Interesting. So, scary good, basically.
I think the overall package is great. Really great.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's hard to find any flaws in his game. And weirdly, I think someone in The Guardian today, probably must have been Louise Taylor, pointed out that the only reason he actually played this season for Sunderland was because Joe Hart wouldn't go there when David Moyes tried to sign him. So... he would have spent the season on the bench otherwise.
Not necessarily, having seen Joe Hart in action.
Well.
But anyway, I take your point. Or Louise's. That's Marco Silva losing that first home match in, 42, 43?
Yeah. And they look genuinely, sort of ashen-faced after it, Hull's players and their fans. I really don't think they saw that one coming.
Oh. And it drops them back into the top three. Bottom three. You're right, it's the bottom three, isn't it? Because Swansea saw Palace losing, saw Hull losing, and they picked up the baton under huge pressure at home to Everton and produced what Swansea boss Paul Clement called one of the proudest moments of his career.
Yeah, he also said the atmosphere at the Liberty Stadium was better than it's been at the Bernabeu.
Wow.
When he was there as assistant manager. They knew exactly what kind of chance that was because they were doing the late kickoff. So there was enormous pressure on them. And Llorente, who I believe came in for some stick recently for sprinting 30 metres over the course of an entire football match.
Oh, yeah.
I think Frank Lampard was pretty dismissive of that. He was there to calm everyone down with a goal in the first half. Everton weren't really at it, by all accounts.
But Swansea have had quite a turnaround. They had a really rotten spell with picking up 1 point in six matches, but they now picked up seven from the past three league games.
Yeah, after Paul Clement had said that he should probably leave the club and then come back again to try and have that effect. I don't know if there's any contractual wranglings in the background. Maybe he did actually resign and then get rehired.
That essentially switch it off and then switch it back on again.
Yeah, it seems to have worked. It seems fine. Also,
when did it ever not work?
Also worth a word about Leon Britton, who 2 weeks ago bought 35 copies of From a Jack to a King, the Swansea City story, on DVD for everyone in the squad to watch. So they were reminded of the story of Swansea and where they've come from. And this week has got the players together to pay for all 3,000 away fans at their next away game. So Leon Britton taking his captaincy role very, very seriously.
The way the fixtures have fallen, they play on Saturday at Sunderland and then then there's a day before Crystal Palace against Hull. So they have the opportunity to put massive pressure on Crystal Palace, particularly should they win at the Stadium of Light.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it would really... I mean, Sunday's game is not going to want for tension, but they could really ramp it up something.
Okay, so they've got Sunderland, and then they're at home to West Brom on the final day. And if they win both games, they're now definitely safe. Hull have the trip to Crystal Palace, and then they host Tottenham. And Palace have Hull, and then they're going to be at Old Trafford. Who's your money on?
Well, it's worth remembering two things here. First of all right, Hull haven't won a game away from home since August, but Crystal Palace managed to lose to Burnley at home, and they hadn't won a game away from home all season.
All right, then.
And also, when it comes to Tottenham on the last day of the season, Newcastle United could tell you a few stories about that, because they battered them 5-1 last year.
Does that apply to Man United as well? Last day of the season?
They drew 5-5 with West Brom on Ferguson's last game.
Okay.
That's the last terrible result I can recall.
Right. If they get to the Europa League final, that will fall a couple of days after that fixture. So not bothered will be very much the message.
As it was on Sunday.
Yeah. All right. So your money, sorry, Ian?
I still think Hull will go down. I just don't think you can start a season with that kind of incompetence from behind the scenes and get away with it. You get punished.
Really?
So I've always thought they'll go down regardless of their bright moments.
Barry?
It's a coin toss, isn't it? I really admire what Marco Silva's done at Hull, so I'd quite like them to stay up for that reason. But then again, the staff at Swansea are probably the friendliest I've ever encountered at any football club
really?
I've ever been at. So for that reason, I'd quite like to see them stay up. Whoever.
Whoever.
Let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah, fair enough. Simon, do you have any strong opinions on this?
No, I mean, not particularly. I do think that Hull are in a very bad spot now, having lost the way the results fell over this weekend. I think they're in a pickle.
I'll tell you what, though. Next medium-sized job to go up for grabs in the Premier League, that's got Marco Silva all over it.
All over it. Arsenal? No, is that not...
Okay. Bad man, Jimbo. Bad man.
So, also this weekend, Bournemouth... and Stoke, they had a 2-2 draw, not on the beach, despite their geographical proximity to that. A match which featured Ryan Shawcross notching up his fifth own goal. He's way behind in the own goal all-time standings. Of course, as you know, Richard Dunn, the all-time champ there with 10. Skirtle and Carragher, both with 7. Fascinating. Leicester had a big win against your lot, Watford, didn't they?
Yeah.
You've now gone 5 straight. You personally now, Simon, have gone... Yeah. 5 straight away games without picking up a point or even scoring.
Yeah, it was a really depressing game, I think, for Watford.
Although the pitch was nice, wasn't it? Did you see the pitch?
The patterns.
How the hell did they do that?
Very pleasant patterns.
Yeah.
Yeah, Watford played some nice stuff and controlled long stretches of the game. And if you just watch the highlights, you would think that it was absolutely 100% Leicester.
Oh.
Because they scored 3 goals and missed 3 or 4 fabulous chances. Could have won 6 or 7, despite Watford controlling long periods of the game. Watford just didn't create or have any ideas of how to create.
Interesting, Simon. time does not permit us to dwell on that fixture, so we will move on because there's been loads of other stuff that we need to talk about, and we'll be doing that after this. Championship next. Newcastle are champions. They pipped Brighton by a single point after the Brighton conceded a last-minute Jack Grealish goal at Villa Park. How many do Newcastle need to compete next season? Asked James Marlin. How many players?
Yeah.
I think he means players. James, I'm guessing you meant players. A lot of other things it could have been.
Yeah, I don't think it's about that, to be honest. If you go back through Newcastle's history since Ashley took over in 2008, you'll find that every time things are looking good, he steps in to make them bad. I would say Newcastle's best hope is to lock him in a broom cupboard until next May.
Really?
Right. I'm just, you know, I'm happy they're happy, but I have a feeling that in about 2 or 3 weeks, some massive thunderbolt's going to hit.
But it's a bit of a downer, isn't it?
It's Newcastle.
They just won the championship.
Every time they're doing well, it happens. Wow. Let's rename the stadium after my own company. That kind of thing. Let's sack Chris Hughton.
Still on that, are you?
Yeah. He's so lovely.
Did you see, David, did you see the goal that Brighton conceded?
I didn't see it, no.
Their game? It was Jack Grealish, who had a pot shot from 20-something yards, and it should have been meat and drink for David Stockdale. It was an easy save, and I just don't understand how he made no attempt to stop it. But in it went. They lost the two games before that. There was that game at Norwich a couple of games ago where Stockdale scored two own goals. Can't really be blamed for either of them. They're both goals that hit the woodwork, came back, hit him in the back and rolled in. But the last few weeks of the season has turned into something of a personal ordeal for him.
Well, it always does for Brighton, doesn't it? But yet they have made it through. They are automatically promoted.
Yes.
Yeah. In the playoffs, instead, will be Reading, who will take on Fulham, and Sheffield Wednesday, who will be up against Huddersfield. Neil Robinson says, what are your thoughts on the Championship playoffs? How do you see them playing out?
I'd love to see Sheffield Wednesday get it. I thought it was... They should have won it last year, the playoffs. Their fans were extraordinary. It'd be great to have them back in the Premier League. And, you know, more than anything else, they're a very good football team.
Okay.
But I do have a sneaky feeling about Fulham, who are probably the most attractive team in the Championship, and a late burst of form, you know what that always does, that little bit of momentum.
Mm. It's not exactly a late burst of form from Fulham. They started the season a bit inconsistently. But if the season were to have started at the beginning of November, they would have won it. And that is most of the season, they've been the best team in the division.
Wow.
So they have to go into that mini tournament as favourites, I think.
Okay. At the bottom, Forest beat Ipswich 3-0, so they stay up. Birmingham stay up, so well done, Harry Redknapp. They beat Bristol City 1-0.
Harry Redknapp, just a note to say that he won as many games in his short time with Birmingham as Zola did in 4 months.
Right. And Blackburn have gone down, despite the fact that they won 3-1 at Brentford.
Whew. Yeah.
Here's Irish Rover 83 saying, I'd be interested to hear the pod's take on Blackburn Rovers' relegation to the third tier, especially given the Guardian's puzzling indifference to the drama unfolding back in the days. This goes on for a bit, but suggests that we were puzzlingly indifferent to what happened when Steve Keane was there and all the Venky nonsense. I don't recall that myself, Irish Rover 83.
I think he's selective amnesia there.
Maybe I misunderstood.
A possible bid to be upset over something that didn't happen. I'm not sure.
I think I
covered it very extensively.
Rovers fans were ignored or derided at the time. I think this might be about their march from one pub to another.
No, there was a period where a few elements of the media, I can't honestly recall if The Guardian was one of them, but I suspect not, were particularly derisive about Blackburn's protests, you know, saying that they were being mean to Steve Keane and things like that.
Oh, really?
It was just some elements of the media.
I definitely, at one point in a podcast, criticised a number of Blackburn fans for, I think, rushing down a set of steps to shout toxic abuse and foul language right into Steve Keane's face, which, you know, if that thinking that's beyond the realms of acceptability is out of order, then I'm guilty.
Producer Ben just wanted to interject that, of course, foul language is something that the Venkies are going to know all about.
I always felt Steve Keane was sort of collateral damage in what had been I mean, the heart got ripped out of that football team, and it was so predictable. You could see it from the first statement that came out of the Venkies as soon as they took over. It was all so obviously happening in front of their eyes, and what were they expected to do? Like, face paint themselves up and clap their way down into the Championship and beyond. They were never coming back. They were, as soon as they got relegated, that's it for them. I wouldn't be surprised if they kept on falling now.
Yikes.
Those owners are an absolute nightmare, and we can't go into too many details because one of the people at the centre of it is quite litigious. But in any kind of business, in any walk of life, if you engage someone to give you advice, you should probably have a look at what their motivations might be. But they, I think in the last four transfer windows, they've spent a cumulative total of $250,000. So I would suspect that their interest in the football club has ended.
Is that genuine figures?
Mm. Yeah. Wow. While selling off players like Rudy Gestede and Josh King for comparatively large amounts. So, yeah, they're
essentially asset stripping the club.
Yeah, I think there are all sorts of wild stories, some of which may be true, that they didn't know that relegation was a thing when they took over. Certainly one story I think I've discussed on here before is that they were actually phoning around asking people how to do a transfer. The thing that scared me very early on was that they said, we've got big plans. They mentioned Ronaldinho, Diego Maradona, taking Blackburn to the top five. But at the time, even more so than now, there's quite a gulf between fifth and fourth in terms of, you know, where you set your budgets and your expectations and what you plan to do. It was quite clear early on they didn't know what on earth they were doing, and they still don't know what on earth they're doing.
Worrying times then for Blackburn. Very sorry about that, Rovers supporters. Nottingham Forest stay up, but it's perhaps significant that they finish worse each season since Fawaz Al-Hazawi took over 5 years ago. Although, hey, here's good news. It looks like he may no longer be in charge soon.
However, it might be. Well, let's just say there are some doubts and concerns over the new owner and his history in professional football.
Right.
It might work out beautifully. Let's hope it does. It might be very much frying pan and fire.
He might fix all their
Olympiacos
problems.
Yes.
In League Two, Barry, final game of the season. What happened?
Well, Portsmouth have gone up as champions ahead of Plymouth on goal difference.
Mm. Remarkable stat, this. Doncaster were top for 129 days. Plymouth were top for 102 days. Pompey were top for 10 minutes.
Oh, but there was 10 minutes that mattered.
Yeah.
But, you know, Plymouth and Doncaster won't be too upset because they both go up automatically as well. And in the playoffs, you've got Blackpool v Luton. And Blackpool seem to have arrested their inexorable slide.
I thought you were going to say their owner for a second. I was getting excited.
Well, wouldn't be the first member of that family to be arrested. But anyway, they will play Luton in the playoffs, while Exeter City will play Carlisle. Now, that's an interesting one. Carlisle beat Exeter 3-2 to get into the playoffs. And now they have to play each other in the playoffs. And I think it's over 1,000 kilometres from one ground to the other. Is that the round trip you did, Macca?
I've done, bizarrely, Carlisle to Plymouth and Carlisle to Yeovil.
Well, so you're going to make up the set?
Don't think my wife would let me.
Yeah,
you went with...
It's a 1,118-kilometre road trip.
Wow.
From Burnham Park.
How long did that take you when you went kind of similar?
We left Carlisle at 10 a.m. on the Tuesday morning. We got to Plymouth at 6 p.m. We left Plymouth at 10 p.m. and we got back to Carlisle at 5 in the morning.
And what did you do all that time?
Well, on the coach?
Mm.
Oh, well, there's a lovely, lovely group of Carlisle fans, about sort of core of somewhere between 40 and 80. And they have their own games. They've got bingo. Lots of paperbacks do the rounds. Lots of chat. They're all friends. It's like a old-fashioned Great British holiday.
Right.
It's a wonderful way to spend the time.
Okay.
They're all mad, obviously, but wonderfully mad.
How many bathrooms on the coach?
Just the one.
Okay.
Yeah. And you have to do that thing where you're weeing on a coach. We have to sort of wedge your head into the corner of the toilet so that you can aim correctly without going on your shoes. Which is, you know, it's a skill that develops over time.
Right. Sitting down a bit, this is if you're a guy, I guess you're thinking.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Right. All right.
Down at the bottom of League Two, as much excitement as anyone who's watching Soccer Saturday will have seen Jeff Stelling getting very, very excited when it looked like Hartlepool were going to stay up. But unfortunately for them, despite beating Doncaster 2-1, wasn't enough. They're gone out of the Football League after 96 years. And the reason they went out was because Mark O'Brien, Newport County's right back, scored his first ever Football League goal to keep his team in the division.
Wow.
And a fine goal it was too. Chested down in the area, smacked a volley into the bottom corner. So
they were 11 points adrift.
Yeah.
But in March, wow. Newport.
That was 11 adrift and they stayed up?
Yeah.
I went down there about a month ago. When Michael Flynn had just taken over as caretaker manager. He's 36. He's a really, really nice guy. Breathtakingly honest with journalists. But he'd taken over a sinking ship under Graham Wesley. They'd hardly won a game for ages. And quite how he's turned it around. And they play on a pitch which they share, not with just one rugby team, but with two rugby teams. So when it's wet, it's like the Somme, and when it's dry, there's a danger the ball will burst when it lands. It's a hideous pitch, and he's done an incredible job, and I would be fairly sure they're going to make him full-time manager now.
Brilliant. Well, well done to them. Excellent. All right, well, we'll catch up on some more stuff, including those big Champions League and Europa League semi-finals, in the final part of this Football Weekly, which comes up after this. Here's a question. Rory O'Hagan says, what does the pod think of the situation at Athlone Town and everything that is happening there? What is the situation, Barry, at Athlone Town?
Athlone Town are a League of Ireland second division team who, not too far from where I grew up, and a friend of mine, a guy I used to work with, Declan Lynch, who's quite a famous journalist in Ireland, he's a Athlone Town fan. Wrote a very good article about it yesterday in the Sunday Independent. But basically, Athlone Town have been accused of match-fixing.
Oh.
A game they played against Longford Town last, not the weekend just gone, but the one before. They lost 3-1. And there were...
suspicious betting patterns?
Oh, very suspicious betting patterns. About, in the Asian betting markets, over 400 grand was... Yeah. Now, I'd say there probably wasn't even 400 people at this game, but 400 grand betted on basically the number of goals and the outcome. You know, that's a broad sort of thing. But UEFA have basically said that there was an entirely one-sided confidence in what the outcome would be,
you know,
how many goals would be scored before halftime and what the losing margin would be. It hasn't gone unnoticed that the Athlone goalkeeper, a Latvian fella, let in a very soft free kick late in injury time. He has denied any wrongdoing, but I think the Football Association of Ireland were going to send their top men to St. Mel's Park or wherever it is Athlone play these days to get to the bottom of this matter.
To be sure.
To be sure. But my mate Declan wrote, what was he saying? He pointed out in his article that Athlone, this is the third thing Athlone have been famous for in their history.
Okay.
The first being in 1974 when their goalkeeper Mick O'Brien was sent off for swinging out of the crossbar in a game against Finn Harps and breaking it.
Oh.
prompting the famous call over at the Tannoy, is there a carpenter in the ground? And then a year later, you may remember this, Jimbo, they held AC Milan 0-0.
Did they?
In a UEFA Cup tie before, wow. I think, that in which one of their players, John Minnock, missed a penalty.
Damn.
And they lost, I think they lost the return leg 3-0 in the San Siro. But, so this is now their third brush with fame.
Wow.
In almost 100 years of existence and a most unsavoury one that everyone seems to find really funny. Despite the gravity of the situation.
It is grave, isn't it? Elsewhere in the wide world of football, there's drama in the Eredivisie, Simon Burton, because you, like all of us, probably thought the final were nailed on for the title. Certainly the Eredivisie officials who turned up at the game that they had against fellow Rotterdam side Excelsior at the weekend, carrying the trophy, thought it was all sorted. They were 4 points clear in that. but they lost 3-0, while Ajax, who were 4 points behind, crushed go-ahead Eagles 4-0. So now it all comes down to the last day there, and police had to use water cannon to disperse the Feyenoord fans who had congregated in the centre of Rotterdam to celebrate the title, but found themselves bereft of anything to get excited about. Right. If you're interested in knowing who you might be watching on Wednesday and Thursday evenings next season in Cups, Leipzig are definitely going to be in the Champions League group stages. Roma and Napoli are still just 1 point apart in the race for second place in Italy. Spartak Moscow are Russian champions. And Antonio Conte's kind of mini-me, Massimo Carrera, fellow Juventus player and basically who's been his deputy all the way through his career until Chelsea. Massimo Carrera was the kind of caretaker boss there who's inherited the job and take them to the title, so well done to him. In the Europa League next year, could be seeing Marseille back. Did you see Patrice Evra scoring his first goal for Marseille? It's a glorious team goal that starts off with a no-look pass from Dimitri Payet for Patrice Evra. Heads it home, this in a game which saw Mario Balotelli scoring again. He's on a rich vein of form. Lazio also going to be in the Europa League. Almost certainly they beat Sampdoria just the 7-3. Last week's racism news saw Sulianni Montari given a one-game ban because he had been he'd been abused by members of the Cagliari crowd, complained to the referee. The referee felt his complaints were too vociferous, gave him a yellow card. Montari, upset at the lack of support from the official, then left the field, received a second yellow for that, and as a consequence got a one-game ban from the authorities. There was uproar about this. Fifth Pro took up his case. The ban was rescinded, but his club dropped him anyway because they were upset that he had appealed rather than going through the club. It wasn't their appeal. It was Montari and Fifth Pro who took the case up. So Pescara apparently were upset that he had left the field, which, okay, they can be, but it just seems bizarre to not deal with that privately.
It's just on a public relations level. Really. Surely someone Pescara, in some meeting.
They're already relegated, aren't
yeah, they?
Are. It's not like they had any impact.
Well, indeed not. Anyway, at least the FIGC did rescind the ban. That is something. There is some sanity in that. This week's story involves Mehdi Benatia, the Moroccan defender of Juventus, who was playing in Saturday night's clash with Torino in the derby. A game which featured Aqua getting sent off, and he was discussing this red card with on one of those little link ups. He's there with his headphones and he's talking to his presenter in the studio. And midway through the interview, he stops and he says, "Who else is on this line?" Because he says that he heard someone say, "Why don't you shut up about it, you Moroccan?" And it's truly bizarre. He says, "Hang on, who else is on this line? Who else is on this line?" And then the presenter's going, "Why? What have you heard?" etc. And then the presenter, who I suspect may have heard it as well, goes, "Well, I think it's best if we just shut this down now. We apologise. Nobody here wants to offend or insult anybody." But it sounds like somebody came on the talkback. The only kind of logical explanation is that somebody came on talkback, didn't realise that maybe the switch was open, that they were keyed, as it were, and said...
Producer Benito.
Yeah. Yeah, very possibly. Anyway, we'll see what happens about that. But Juventus are taking the subject extremely seriously indeed. Let's move on to happier notes.
Sorry,
Ian,
I just got that. Producer Benito.
Yeah, it was good, didn't it?
It took a while.
Yeah. I just want to stress that there's no way producer Ben would be involved.
No, good God. No.
He says whatever he wants about us to our faces. Yeah.
Now, there's Champions League semis to talk about in a second. And Simon, Man United, Celta Vigo. But I propose to delay that yet further by asking this question to Ian McIntosh from Nicola Berti, who says, "Can Ian please give us more information about his civilization project?" What's your civilization project, Ian?
In a continuing effort to relive adolescence, I'm currently playing Civilization 4 and writing about it on the set pieces.
All right, much as you did with Championship Manager.
Yeah, very much the same way. And if I can find some way to get 10,000 words out of Jet Set Willy, then damn it, I will.
All right, Jet Set Willy.
Oh, what a game. Civilization.
Sid Meier's Civilization.
Yeah, the kind of you take sole control of a group of settlers in 4000 BC and then you have to invent technologies. It's what me and James Horncastle played on the train that time for about 8 hours.
You've posted some pretty cryptic tweets about the state of your civilization? How long has it been going, and how is your ant farm going?
Well, we're 1,000 BC now, but we're under serious pressure from the Aztecs.
3,000 years already?
Yeah, the Aztecs are to the east of us, the Mongols are to the west of us,
right.
And here we are stuck in the middle with rudimentary hand tools.
Okay. Yeah. So not well, then?
Not brilliantly right now, but I dare say once I've reinvigorated my economy, everything will be fine.
Can it be played competitively?
I think so,
In Korea, for example, are there e-players of Civilization?
Well, possibly. I mean, someone was telling me that in the Asian esports scene, players actually wear nappies so that they don't have to have any toilet break. They can just continue. And given that your average game of Civilization takes about 16 hours to play in total, I think nappies would be definite. But, you know, if there's money in it...
Cartman do that when he was playing... what was the game they were playing on?
Was that the Warcraft episode?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's messy business. But if you
want
to get to the top...
So you
know. No. But I just take my laptop into the loo with me.
Yeah, that's true. Right. Having reached our second anecdote about you in the bathroom of this podcast, let's finish off by turning to the Champions League semi-finals and the Europa League semi-finals. All right. It looks quite straightforward. As you know, listener, Juve had a 2-0 win away in Monaco. They haven't lost at home in Europe since 2013, although it was a 2-0 scoreline to Bayern Munich, which obviously would send us into extra time. I think that one looks pretty cut and dry. We can talk about that after it happens. Atletico Real, 3-0 at the Bernabeu to Real Madrid. It's going to be the last European game ever at the Calderon, the second last game of any description there before they knock the whole thing down. Wow. Quite an occasion then, however one-sided the tie looks after that first leg. Do you think they could wave goodbye with something very special, Simon? Atletico?
You would have thought that if there's going to be drama in either game, it would probably be in Turin.
Really?
Well, just it only takes one goal there
to
set things on a knife edge. And from there, you would have to, obviously, Juventus have won 2-0 away from home, go into that game as strong favourites. But Monaco, they are goal scorers. They have shown that across the season. They showed it in the first leg that they're capable of creating goals and creating chances against Juventus.
Mm.
They only need to score the first goal. So as a football fan, I go into that game hopeful that it might be exciting.
Hmm.
The second leg of the Madrid derby, not so much.
Not so much, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It has the sense of occasion.
Yes.
But 3-0 is surely too big a deficit.
They did beat Real Madrid 4-0 there a couple of years ago.
There is a difference between a one-off game and a match in which one team arrives knowing they have a three-goal cushion.
That's true. And you can't... Can you imagine Real Madrid not scoring in this game?
I don't know when it was they last failed to score in a game.
59 games ago or something like that. It was. Yeah. It's a very, very long time
something
ago. Yeah, so, yeah, absolutely. All right. Okay. Meanwhile, on Thursday, Barry, for your excitement and delectation, there's the Europa League.
Mm-hmm.
Which game are you going to choose to tune into?
I won't watch any game.
Really? You feel that's enough football?
I've generally had it with football by Thursday. I need a night off to get myself enthused again for the week ahead.
Which is a shame because Ajax have been great fun to watch. And somebody was writing in saying that we'd been a bit down, or I personally have been a bit down, imagine that, on Ajax. And when we were talking about their first leg against Lyon, I may have said they were a bit wide open at the bat, because there were plenty of chances of both sides, but they looked terrific going forward. And certainly the match against Lyon, the games against Schalke, they look really, really dangerous. If Man United do get through against Vigo, Ajax are going to be quite a handful in the final in Stockholm. It's 4-1 anyway between Ajax and Lyon after the first leg at the Amsterdam Arena. Ajax did go 2-0 down at Schalke in their second leg after being similarly dominant in the first leg of that quarterfinal clash. So it's not impossible that Lyon might open this up in a similar way by getting an early goal after their away goal in Amsterdam, particularly because Lacazette should be back. He should be available for this game. Plus, Ajax still have those title hopes, so then maybe that's going to be playing on their mind. Mm. All right, you a Ajax fan, Ian?
Do you know, I haven't seen him this season.
Have you not?
At all.
Oh, well, no. This would be an exciting choice for you, unless you want to watch the other game on Thursday night, which is Man United against Vigo.
Dear God, no.
Really?
I just feel all I've done recently is Man United games, and only one of them's been good, and that was against Chelsea. I think Thursday's date night anyway.
So, is it? What are you planning to do?
Well, ultimately, at the end of it.
All right, then. Well, much the same as Man United's plans, in which case, I imagine.
Play civilization. But in a kind of uncivilized way.
Right. Nice. Anyway, back to Man United. A slip up here, Simon, I think it's fair to say, would be catastrophic. And there's only one goal in it. That's drama.
Yeah, there's potential. United are really fallible. Defensive issues. And they rested several players against Arsenal. But still, their defence... I mean, Celta Vigo will come into this match for all that they lost at home.
Mm.
Will come into this match hopeful that they can do something. Yeah.
It's got one all written all over it in 10-foot high letters. They'll score first, and that is Celta Vigo. And then Phil Jones, with a glancing header, of which he knows very little, will put Man United back in it.
Boom.
Yeah.
Thanks for that, Ian. We'll see.
Right. Don't have to watch it now.
We'll be examining the veracity of your prediction. Oh, no, we won't, because it happens on Thursday night.
Oh, yeah.
Curses.
Oh, well, we'll be examining the veracity of it the following Monday.
Yeah, well, yeah. Okay, fair enough. We'll do that.
It's a date.
But that's it for this edition of Your Football Weekly. Many thanks to all concerned, and we will be back on Thursday to take stock of the situation ahead of a busy weekend. So do make time for us then, listeners. In the meantime, I personally will be going to see Alien Covenant this evening, the latest prequel from the Aliens franchise, and I'll be airing my thoughts on that in Wednesday's edition of the very exciting Truth and Movies podcast. Have you got any plans for the week, Simon? Apart from listening to Truth and Movies?
Obviously, I'll be listening to Truth and Movies. I have few plans for this week. I'm going to the Women's FA Cup final at the weekend, though.
Ah.
I'm taking my children. I think it's going to be a really good family occasion.
Okay.
The way, the, like, the sold tickets, I'm sure they're still available, free for children.
Hmm.
I expect it to be full of people who are really excited and happy to be there. Don't particularly care who wins, and are happy to watch two great teams play for an important title.
Okay.
I'm excited about that.
Which are the teams?
I believe it's Manchester City against Birmingham City.
Okay. All right. Well, that should be a splendid day. Is that Saturday?
That is Saturday, yeah.
At the Wembley?
At the Wembley Stadium.
Boom.
Yeah, book your tickets.
Okay.
I think it's a good thing.
Barry?
We'll be spending Tuesday morning on my back in a dentist chair getting root canal surgery.
Oh, no!
So, in a room full of people who will be very unexcited and unhappy to be there. And then I have to pay loads of money for the privilege.
Why a room full of people? How many people are going to be attending?
Well, I would imagine two at least.
Oh, okay, right. And you don't want to be there, yeah.
Well, I certainly don't want to be there. They probably do.
Well, maybe they do. I mean, maybe they take pleasure in their work. You know, a job well done, a root canal sorted.
Yeah. I've had one before.
No.
It's not as bad as they say, but it's certainly not pleasant.
No. Well, on that note, listeners, however grim your Tuesday morning might be,
so
just
Ian's
think of
getting his leg
Barry.
Over. He's off to the FA Cup final, and I'm getting my mouth torn apart.
No.
Rusty tools.
Jesus.
Yeah, we'll be back on Thursday. See you then, listeners.
The Guardian.